Airing on Asheville FM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week you'll hear from Juan and Fatima, two people who've been organizing and thinking about the southern U.S. border for a long time, to speak about the escalation in border force violence and kidnapping by ICE and CBP around the U.S., including Minneapolis, where Fatima resides, an explosion in proposed immigration detention, including near El Paso, where Juan resides, the expansion of low-intensity conflict and counterinsurgency in the Southwest since the mixing in of language of war on crime, war on drugs, global war on terror, and great replacement, and how autonomous mutual aid provides opportunities for scaling up community defense and prefiguring the world we want to see. You can check our show notes for links to relevant projects and articles. If you're listening to the radio edition, you can find an additional half an hour by joining in on our podcast or subscribing to your favorite streaming app listed at tfsr.media.
My name is Fatima, they, them. I'm based in Minneapolis, where I grew up, but I used to do border work on the U.S.-Mexican border in Arizona. And I've been involved in no border movements around the world for about 20 years.
Hello, my name is Juan, and I'm from the border. We're doing work. My pronouns are he, him. Do work primarily on both sides of the Mexican-American border in El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez. And we're from a group called Casa Carmelita and La Cruz Rosa, which is a coalition of folks that got together to do water drops and provide aid for people trekking through the desert in the surrounding West Texas, southern New Mexico desert.
I was hoping that we could talk about the escalating offensive by the Department of Homeland Security in the name of immigration enforcement, and in particular, how it's impacting folks living around that border. Juan, could you tell us a bit about yourself, your work around issues of immigration, Casa Carmelita, and the communities that it serves, and how?
Okay, so I'm ancestrally, my name is Juan, I'm ancestrally from the border. So my family's been here through generations since before the border, kind of lived through every iteration of social upheaval in the histories of the border, on both sides of the border, because there is an ancient pathway from Chihuahua, parts of Durango, up to El Paso, so much so that the oldest neighborhoods in El Paso are Duranguito and Chihuahuita, because it's such a ancestral pathway since indigenous times when people would trek to the desert. Hence, even in the name El Paso, like, it's always been synonymous, even before the border, with migration. There just happens to be an imaginary line through there now, but up in Mount Cristo Rey, where we do water drops, there's tracks of dinosaurs, because it was even an ancient pathway since prehistoric times. So I always stop. The University of Texas El Paso put a sign out there that shows a dinosaur crossing. And I always stop to make sure people understand that that little pathway between the Sierra Madres Occidentales, which are on the, like what they are called, what the mountain range is called south of the border, and the Franklin Mountains, which are what those mountains are called north of the border, that little divide between has been a pathway for migration since prehistoric times. And that just, you know, visualizes it. They put it as a joke, but it helps visualize how much El Paso is defined by migration. We started off our organization as an occupation of Tornillo, the Children's Detention Center in Tornillo, Texas, which is a suburb, an outlier of El Paso. And this is when basically is zero tolerance was instituted, and zero tolerance set off a chain of events in which these emergency makeshift facilities started arising all over our community, so that they can basically, in essence, circumvent their own federal laws. Things like the Flores Act that protected children and the amount of times that they could be incarcerated. They had to work around that. And the best way to do that is start this language of emergency, so that they could erect these makeshift facilities to house children, basically children that have been separated from the parents, because you can't house children and adults together. So zero tolerance set a chain of events where, you know, children are being accused of a crime and being treated as criminals, and parents needing to be separated from their children, and the phenomenon of family separation, which had always existed, just morphed into this current form. And out of that resistance to that occupation and the Children's Detention Center, we, a group of us from across the country, from Albuquerque, indigenous groups from Albuquerque, groups out of Tucson, autonomous groups, social-minded groups out of all the Southwest, people from the Baltimore Uprising and the Ferguson Uprising got together, and locals here in El Paso got together to basically put up whatever resistance we could and do direct actions and just do whatever we could to start setting off a, doing whatever we could to get the facility shut down, or if not, to make it as disruptive as possible. We settled into the port of entry, and we took over the port of entry that's there in terms of where the gates and such are there. And then when we got together, we realized that El Paso, they were leaving migrants, dumping off migrants in downtown El Paso at the Greyhound station and other places in mass with no, absolutely no preparation. And now that's commonplace. But back then that was like a watershed moment here where they started doing that in mass. It eventually led to thousands, but back then it was just dozens. And so our occupations both turned to resistance and assistance. Not just from resistance, but to a model of resistance and assistance, because we were sitting on all these resources that we were going to occupy for months. So we started distributing those throughout the community, sending our volunteers to help the makeshift shelters that were popping up. And out of that was born a physical space for our work called Casa Carmelita, that eventually turned into a shelter and safe space for the most marginalized we were finding on the streets through our feedings and whatnot. And that was, you know, in essence, our beginning. It's looked, the work has looked very different as there's been different like iterations of emergency crises here. But the need, the constant need for mutual aid and a model for mutual aid, where in the rest of the city it was following a very humanitarian and more predominantly religious modality, we were one of the first that started doing more of a model of mutual aid and community work, and that was not beholden to those models. So our current form, we're doing water drops. We're resisting the latest gargantuan detention center called Camp East Montana, which is supposedly can hold up to 6,000 people. There's already been deaths. We were letting the community know and protesting that since before the opening of the camp, but already knowing that just like every other camp, there will be deaths, there'd be outbreaks of tuberculosis, which there has been, measles and all manner of things. But this has led to the city kind of awakening to the fact that these gargantuan detention centers are bringing not only a stress to the infrastructure, but a lot of death, a lot of deaths and suffering on the part of migrants. So the city just recently passed, and we've been one of the groups at the forefront of that fight. To stop the newest proposal for even a bigger detention center. And basically, in essence, like our current form is doing water drops and resisting the camps, the detention centers that are popping up and fighting any more expansion. And just recently, the city passed an ordinance in El Paso County to look into stopping the detention centers and not collaborating with detention centers. So that's been a success. But that's up to our current work and our beginnings.
Fatima, about a decade ago, you wrote this really good essay zine called The Insurgent Southwest. What experience can you share about borders since you've worked around a few of them? And can you briefly synopsize the zine, share what motivated you to publish it, and where you feel it sits after so many years?
So I published that zine in 2013, and at the time I'd been doing border work on the U.S.-Mexican border for about 6 years, and I had primarily been doing that work with the humanitarian aid organization that was shifting over from humanitarian aid as a model into a more mutual aid model. And I wrote the zine because a friend, Christian Williams, was putting an anthology together about counterinsurgency and wanted essays that were about the application of counterinsurgency and low-intensity warfare in the U.S. So I think for me, I just wanted to clarify common misconceptions people have about border policy. Folks think the main purpose of border policy is to stop the flow of migration, but you know, it really isn't the main purpose of border policy, and specifically counterinsurgency on the border and now in the interior, is to manage mixed-status communities and I think, you know, we can think about the trajectory of counterinsurgency domestically on the border as an increase in internal checkpoints, deputization of the police, you know, of vigilant citizenry. And these controls all get justified kind of the same way historically that the prison boom did, you know, the war on drugs, racism, a myriad of fears about crime. And the inward expansion of the border is really kind of a careful balance of hard and soft controls as are enacted by police, military, paramilitary, nonprofits, and civilians. And I wanted to offer just a simple tool for folks to understand the difference between hard controls, which are things like imprisonment, deportation, torture, deprivation, assault, and death, which, you know, a relatively small number of people participate in, to a soft control, which is information gathering, reporting to state authorities, psychological operatives, and ideological warfare, which increasingly are kind of woven into our daily lives. I think, you know, counterinsurgency presents the blurring of police and military functions as an inevitability, and it focuses on managing populations within a territory. And it really wants to normalize a level of surveillance that is participatory. So I wanted people to understand that border militarization, internal controls only really function well because people accept kind of like the discursive logic of those categories and what they're policing. And I think that we can see, you know, the papers someone holds only have value because someone else is without them. And this value is kind of created on scarcity. So it's a manufactured worth. It's an effective tool of control because not everyone can obtain the right kind of documentation. We see this very specifically with the shift discursively between previous administrations and the current one. Like, they're literally going down a data list of people who have tried to play right and tried to go through the asylum process as requested by the system. Like, they have everyone's information because you are required to give the state information about where you live and where you work if you're applying for asylum. And now with the shift in enforcement priorities under Trump, people who thought that they were trying to obtain their legal recourse in the way the state was asking them have now found themselves kind of recriminalized. And, you know, delineations reinforce something. Like, citizenship gives people something to like spiritually hold and rally around. It creates a false sense of community and security. You know, it's the process by which the state and corporations are taken on through citizenship. And like, essentially, it's a participatory control. You know, I wrote the zine trying to get people to understand that the border is everywhere, like, wasn't a metaphor and it was a reality and it functions because so many people accept the idea that the state should be allowed to police our communities through these arbitrary categories of citizenship. And I wrote it as a warning about the ways that I saw society shifting. And, you know, by and large, the vision it painted, which was a pretty dark one, has come to fruition. And we are in that moment now.
This is The Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing our interview with Juan and Fatima about solidarity with immigrants and resisting immigration detention in the Southwest and beyond. Hey, KPFA listeners, we're interrupting this week's interview with Juan and Fatima on The Final Straw Radio to ask you to take a second and consider what the station means to you and your community. If you scan through the airwaves right now, you're surely going to hear a selection of pop hits, you know, maybe some religious preaching, some right-wing talk, and some centrist news parroting the lines of the ruling elites. More likely still, you'll hear advertising jingles that will worm into your memory for the rest of the day. To be honest, it's quite unlikely that you'll hear anything else on the dial like what you're hearing on KPFA. You won't hear local and global perspectives, perspectives from the communities struggling for autonomy and equality. You won't hear the poetry and the performance, the songs of resistance and inspiration, or the experimental content that is foundational to this progressive radio station. There are 24 hours, 7 days a week, for 77 years worth of examples of this station reflecting and feeding the vibrancy of struggles for justice and resonating an impact far beyond the reach of these airwaves. If you value the contribution of this station to your life and to your community, please consider a tax-deductible donation by visiting kpfa.org and hitting the donate button, or giving a call to 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Even better, you could join the Guardians of KPFA, who make regular monthly donations to KPFA throughout the year to sustain our mission of informed communities in motion. Thank you for your time, and back to the episode. So how is detention generally, and immigration detention in particular, in Texas since Trump's first administration changed through the passing administrations? And where does it stand now in terms of conditions, oversights, and who runs them?
You know, the corporations that are really at the core of this privatization are groups like Geo Group, CoreCivic, aviation providers like CSI Aviation, technology firms like Palantir, other major vendors, Dilettoni, MVM Inc., AT&T, General Dynamics. And there has been a huge influx of federal funding into expanding DHS. It is one of the best funded parts of the government currently, and it's expanding at a rate that we have not seen previously. And the groundwork for this really harkens back to Arpaio in Arizona and the tent cities that he created during the enforcement era of SB 1070, which was a law in Arizona that deputized the police to check immigration. Historically, it really should be said, immigration through the INS was a civil issue, and over the last 20 years, it's been increasingly criminalized. This is actually a new development. Whether or not you were in the country with status or not used to be a civil issue, not a criminal issue. And obviously, after the 90s prison boom, there was incentives to expand the prison population, and immigration is now the new kind of cutting edge economic opportunity for these private corporations to be getting millions of dollars in contracts with the federal government. And I could go down the list of which companies for like a much longer period of time, but all of this information is available online. And these companies are transparent about it. I mean, they're sharing these growth opportunities with their investors and putting this information on their websites because they are proud of this model. To the specifics of detention in Texas, I will let Juan talk more about this, but I think it is not hyperbolic to discuss these detention facilities as death camps. There have been 17 measles cases in El Paso, 13 of them are in East Montana. There have been 3 confirmed deaths in the last 3 months of the 9 people killed by ICE, and they're directly related to people being assaulted and killed by guards, medical neglect. They've been shifting how they process deaths in custody. They've been shopping around for Office of Medical Examiners who will not do things like declare deaths homicides. And they have shifted over who's processing those bodies to the military base because they don't want to be held to account for deaths in custody. And with the planned expansion of detention that the federal government has planned, we will only see an increase in deaths in custody. You know, I think it is worth saying that this is not the first era of heightened deaths in custody. There have been many people over the years who have died in custody, but just in the last 3 months alone, and folks who are dying in custody are dying because they're being held there and because they're being abused. You know, we could go down the names of the people who died and how old they are. Francisco Gaspar Andres was a 40-year-old Guatemalan man who died in East Montana of liver and kidney failure after being hospitalized. This is a direct example of poor medical care. Lortho Sims, 59, was a Cambodian man who died in late February. His death is under investigation. Obviously, there have been deaths of citizens resisting ICE enforcement, like Renee Good and Alex Preddy. Victor Manuel Diaz was a Nicaraguan immigrant who was found unresponsive in East Montana. ICE has listed his death as a presumed suicide, but his family disputes that that was a presumed suicide. You know, Edward Sanchez Dominguez was a 34-year-old Mexican national. He was found hanging in his cell in the Robert Dayton Detention Facility in Georgia. Parity Lau was a 46-year-old Cambodian immigrant who died in Philadelphia, like ostensibly due to organ failure. Luis Batun Jan Cruz was a 68-year-old Honduran immigrant who died in California from heat-related issues. Luis Gustavo Nunez Carceles was a 42-year-old Honduran immigrant who died in a Texas hospital after multiple medical emergencies while in custody. And then Hernando Lunas Campos was a 55-year-old Cuban immigrant who recently died in East Montana. And his death was ruled a homicide. by asphyxiation. And there were witnesses who have since been deported. So I think this paints a very dark, dark picture of impunity to assault and kill people in custody. And it's very clear that there will not be legal consequences for ICE killing people in custody or, you know, as we've seen in Minneapolis, community members who are trying to resist the abductions of their neighbors.
And like I was always saying, it's how many deaths before it justifies the label death camp, right? And Fatima's so on point with so much, like all of these questions are so combined. There's so much synergy between all these different issues, but it's really causal, direct correlation. So that just from what I was hearing there, and I'll speak to the context of what we experienced, but I think speaking specifically towards a question which was in the last iteration, because I wanted to make sure people understand that there's been cycles of these dynamics over a period of time. We just happen to come from Indigenous people who have lived through generations of these, especially when the further questions that talk about invasion and replacement. I mean, it goes hand in hand with genocide and settler colonialism and invasion. But for us, the watershed moment that kind of showed, and the way I frame it for people who aren't from El Paso, is that this the seminal moment for us was when zero tolerance was enacted in practice. I think in paper, there's many ways you could construe it as already saying that there was, you know, some kind of civil offense around crossing, but for sure that invoking criminal law made it so that where children and toddlers are having to have their rights read to them, being incarcerated as if it was a criminal offense. And so you see these makeshift shelters coming up because family separation is leading directly to people's arrests. So that's why I say to people that shift is the one that started to stress the systems in El Paso that had been around for generations to aid migrants, because all those had already existed. So changing it from mostly a civil infraction to a criminal stressed the Las Americas, Estrella, other local El Paso groups that had aided in the legal defense. The need for legal defense just exploded. The having to house families separately, the charging everyone with criminal offense versus all these other policies like catch and release made it so that there was an expansion in a different way, not just the mass expansion, which I'll talk about the mass incarceration part, which is very much on point. That stressed a house which had provided people coming out of detention with a place to stay. And so when they were filled to capacity, that's when you started seeing migrants being left in the street with no recourse, simply because all of those systems that had been set up over time in El Paso, mind you, these were all mostly non-state actors. A great majority of them were humanitarian aid groups, most of them charitable and Catholic at the time, like A House and Estrella. But there was, you know, a network of churches and others that did the same. So that stressed that part. Like every part of a system that had been set up over generations became stressed with now you have in mass people being charged with a criminal offense, not just immigration related offenses. And again, a lot of those iterations that happened, like Fatima was saying, since the beginning of colonization in these areas where, I mean, there was concentration camps when during the Mexican Revolution, when Mexican asylum, in essence, asylum seekers back then were being housed at Fort Bliss. At one point, it was a concentration camp for Japanese internment. But this language of emergency and the language of war that you see enacted, that now it seems commonplace, I think was built. And it's good to remind folks that was, you know, the edifice and was built on the foundation of mass incarceration, especially in Texas, which you asked me to frame it in. It's built the biggest, you know, mass incarceration apparatus that the world has ever known. And here we are being told that they can't house in a human way all of these migrant asylum seeking folks, which is what let us know it's really not about capacity to house. It's about setting the draconian conditions for people to suffer, people being kept under cages, people, you know, in all manner of dehumanizing ways, including up until these death camps, which we knew were coming, because just like during Trump's first administration, where he was fixating on El Paso because I think El Paso personifies so much of the politics that he's framing himself, his constituency against. We're a truly bicultural, binational community with statistically, like, that defy a lot of his stereotypes, that defy a lot of what he sees as wrong with the country. And in actuality, we make it work. Our community, you know, has this long storied history that represents a diversity and a multiculturalism and a duality that for Western chauvinists, for, you know, Christian nationalists, for all of these different groups have always posed a threat. And why El Paso has always posed such a threat to him throughout history and our history of real revolt against those since the wars in San Eli over salt, which in essence were over capitalization and privatization of salt mines, to the Bath riots that were more like uprisings than riots, where it was Mexicans again over the issue of immigration fighting for their rights and the fighting the dehumanization. And our namesake, Carmelita Torres, is a 16-year-old that rebelled against the treatment at the Immigration Processing Center, where our location was directly across from our Casa Carmelita location. So there's been a long history of resistance in our community to the treatment of people in migration, but also that went hand in hand with El Paso. Because as I like to tell people, El Paso being part of Texas is a game changer for us, because I tell people that we exist in these three Souths. The South that's very much part of the Confederacy, that's part of this binary of black and white. So, you know, we were under Jim Crow. We're under Texas laws. As soon as you pass the New Mexico border, you see abortion being, there's abortion clinics, there's gambling. There's, you know, dispensaries, because so many laws that are Texas is so much more conservative than even our neighbor New Mexico. And so you see the laws change drastically from one side to another. But there's that long history of resistance. And for me, that's just this war that's been declared against people of color in our community, particularly Mexican Americans, but we just happen to be part of this other South, this global South. And I say people, we're also part of a global South because we really do exist on both sides of the border. And so we can go into Juarez and live, you know, an experience being Mexican American to a degree that other people can't, you know, an experience with their motherland that other ethnicities can't. And we're part of the Southwest, another South, in that there's always been indigeneity in our community, where in other parts of the country is a much more black and white binary. But for me, these generations of war, war against drug, war against terror, war against immigration, are now meshing into one in which you can clearly see, you know, that tactic. And from that, to me, speaks more of the language of illegalizing bodies and creating a criminal class that's easy to label as security threat groups. And of course, we see this weaponization of labeling going back as far as we can remember as a people, because we were some of the first people othered. I tell people, because Anzaldúa made a powerful metaphor about the border being a wound, an open wound, but I also tell people it's also a womb. You know, we were one of the first places where the othering began. We were a place of first contact between Oñate and the indigenous people of this area, which included my people. But for me, it's important to let people know this system of mass incarceration, this system of othering goes back to the foundation of this country and the way it's always treated diversity. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it also goes hand in hand with a rise of what we're going to talk about in a little about this language of invasion and replacement. And that has always come whenever people of color have become a perceived threat to the nation state.
This is the Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing our interview with Juan and Fatima about solidarity with immigrants and resisting immigration detention in the Southwest and beyond. Can you talk about, like, the normalcy of this language of genocide in the U.S. political landscape? Do you think that this reflects some sort of hegemonic, like, overall U.S. viewpoint outside of just being in the Southwest region? Is it an amplification of one side of an increasingly divided society with you know, people talking about the slow civil war going on in the U.S., or do you think it's something else?
Is that directed towards me?
That's, yeah, if you want to pick up there, that's great.
Yeah, because, I mean, kind of left off on that language because it's very much been part and parcel of it. And you're right. For me, the attack on immigration also coincides with the attack on anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, the rise of Western chauvinism, the language of genocide that also includes this language of pro-colonization. For a long time, for as long as I can remember, my generation was sold, you know, was constantly being courted by the right wing, especially here in Texas. That's such a... It's been a target for right wing, especially under Bush, trying to court our demographic, our Mexican American community, into becoming more, if not centrist, like right wing. But where we didn't hear, you know, it was much more covered up, the language. There's a lot of the language that we now see coming forth that's much more overt about Western civilization. I remember that the census, the near around 2000, where it was a very marked difference in the attitudes of people saying, you know, we're going to become a minority country. And people will actually laugh about it and say that we were going to become majority. But there are a lot of us who had been lived through that kind of ethnic violence and racialized violence knew that always comes with this perceived threat, and that people should be taking it much more seriously as a threat and not just something as factual. But it's for us that grew up under the old, you know, Southern kind of racism that had existed since the formation of the state, recognize this diversity, equity, inclusion, this Western chauvinism, this language of genocide and pro-colonization is a form of, you know, the white supremacy and ethnic cleansing that it had been enacted against our communities. And if people remember some of the first language, especially during that first administration that I say that Trump was fixating in El Paso, he started off with Mexican Americans and expanded from there. As a matter of fact, a major part of that language was his use of groups like the Mexican Mafia, Mara Salvatrucha. But I, as a person who writes about this extensively, say have to remind people these were all born from the criminal, you know, the criminal justice apparatus of the United States that we exported abroad, and the United States government was fully aware that we were exporting this social problem to countries that didn't have the infrastructure for it. And the United States government was born. I have groups there. There's a particularly disagreeable gentleman named Matt, by the last name Man Waring, who had talked about this and talked about the potential for these groups, as they were mentioning, as insurgency, non-ideological insurgents. Of course, he was using that language to scare, but in essence, very fully aware of understanding that we were exporting that social issue to a country that couldn't. And that set off cycles of young people coming up here, escaping those very gangs, mind you, from something, a dynamic that we had created. And I have to remind folks, now that morphed into the language of Tenderawa Arawa, but with Trump, it's been one of those things that you can clearly see the progression from. And again, El Paso at our core represents, we disagree with him so vehemently, it's almost, you know, in our DNA to be pitted against one another, because he represents all of these histories of the United States that we disagree with, and we represent all of the histories that he disagrees with. But for me, this morphing, you could really see it in the George Floyd uprisings, when a lot of our youth were downtown protesting that situation. There was such a massive, because I tell people El Paso's become such a military city state, there was such a massive presence of law, what you would call law enforcement. I imagine at this point, I don't know what you would call the entire apparatus, but there was, you couldn't differentiate between who was BORTAC, who was police, who was military. And for us, that was the true moment in which we understood that had all morphed into one citizen and non-citizen alike. I mean, the Walmart shooter entered into that Walmart with absolutely no regard as to whether or not people were citizens or weren't citizens, and used that exact language that back then, at least people like at the beginning at face value would say that was even Trump was hesitant to just come out and support that language of invasion that we had been hearing since the 2000 census, and especially after 9/11. where it's now become, you know, commonplace in the right wing, like not even an extreme right wing, but in the Republican Party itself, like as mainstream as it can get. Whereas that language had been common during, you know, these different time periods in which there was racist violence. I think for me, the groundswell that we see now comes from that history. But for us, in effect, it's just the state manifesting the different versions in which it would, like Fatima was saying, exert control over us. And mind you, it starts with one community, but it winds up encompassing everyone, which is why I'm really happy to see that now people are framing under a violation of due process. Because in essence, that's when you start really seeing the attack on, regardless of who it is, attack on people's constitutional rights and inalienable rights. And so for me, those moments in which we were running into this kind of oppression by what had morphed into one singular apparatus, whether it be BORTAC, whether it be military, whether it be any of these, is where those things have truly morphed and based off these idea, the language of war and the language of emergency, you know, that's commonplace now. And labeling everyone's security threat groups and enemy aliens, I think, again, this is really the coming together of all these different and seemingly desperate things into what we see now. And I think Trump and his underlings have been good, like purposely been creating that into a singular, you know, a singular argument into why it is that they can violate due process for anybody and everybody.
I think it's helpful for people to think about a political concept called the Overton window, which describes the range of political ideas and policies that are considered acceptable in the public discourse over a given time. This was keyed and developed by a political scientist named Joseph Overton in the 90s, and it really is a framework to understand how shifts in political and culture acceptance happen. And we're in a time where the Overton window for what is acceptable is shifting so far to the right, and it'll still be a pendulum effect, but they use the acceptability of extreme enforcement and experiences to then get the general populace to settle into and accept a less egregious but equally problematic level of enforcement. And you can see that right now in real time with people's discussions around Operation Metro Surge in Minnesota about, you know, as long as there are not paramilitary forces extrajudicially executing citizens in the street, are people going to be okay with a new level of ICE enforcement in their communities as long as they don't have to directly engage with it? And I think that we can see the dialogue within resistance movements about when people will effectively resist or when they will kind of settle into accepting a certain level of carceral societal at baseline is exactly what's happening currently. And I think there have been many things that have shifted people's public perception of safety in the Midwest over the last 3 months in ways that folks in other parts of the country, specifically the Southwest, have been dealing with for decades. And obviously, it does come down to racialized categories within U.S. society.
Do you have any insights into how people can incorporate political and social organizing, this life as organizing, into their daily lives so that they're more ready to activate and grow social resistance when the time is needed in their area? Because if these forces are shifting from place to place, if these facilities are popping up, if people that are detained in one community are getting transferred even short term into the local jail that's doing a hold on behalf of ICE. Yeah, I wonder if you have any sort of insights into how people can start ramping up their attentiveness and their organizing so that they have these networks and relationships in place when they're needed.
So I can speak to that a little bit. You know, they expect us to go back to being okay with this like hidden carceral society and system that is in place, right? They, you know, use categories of narco-insurgency and counterinsurgency to shape our daily lives. They create self-controls that they expect people to just participate in out of economic necessity. And, you know, I think people have been doing really pragmatic coalition work, but not all of it is anti-statist. And I think that's a necessary part of resistance. You know, we can't confuse tactical coalitions with passive acceptance of ideological tendencies like a desire for humane border policy as though if BORTAC just goes back to enforcing in places like El Paso, people in Minnesota should be okay with that. You know, if we're not careful, this kind of like status logic can become border management instead of resistance. And people are really at risk of that. You know, people go to these protests and you hear these pleas for an expansion of citizenship and people say, oh, we're not criminals. And I just really want people to understand the way that community organizing can be used to manage populations and control in ways that are recuperative. And it's really important that we learn the lessons that security analysts and military theorists who write about border enforcement are trying to teach us. Like, the major issue at hand is the legitimacy and a battle for legitimacy. And history teaches us that nation states and boundaries can shatter. So, like, do we believe that the empire is beginning to crumble? And what are, you know, the tools that we can use to kind of dismantle their legitimacy? Like, we are being asked to accept an insane upscaling of incarceration in this country, and people would be willing fools to think that it won't eventually expand to include someone that they love, even if they are not currently part of a targeted population. So I think we can see with Trump's desire to strip certain people of citizenship. I think we can see, for example, the state of Kansas just this week has demanded that all transgender people turn in their driver's license and has basically stripped them of their right to vote in that moment, however you might feel about that as a strategy, and also their right to like exist within the state. So I think, you know, we know from experiences in the border what the state is doing, you know, and we've experienced it now in the Midwest, the paramilitary violence, volatile racial exchange, mass incarceration. Like, none of this is a pretty picture of the future. But the one silver lining is that, like, the state is losing its mask of humane governance and people can take a position on methods of social control. And they're going to need to, you know. I think the security industry is huge because it plays on people's feelings of dealing with an unstable world and like resource scarcity. And I think the beautiful part of resistance to what's currently been happening in Minnesota is how people have rejected a scarcity model and they've said, no, there is enough. We can help our neighbors. You know, I'm part of a hyper local mutual aid group that just makes sure the families on my immediate block have food, their kids can get rides to school, their rent is paid. We are seeing people become intimately involved in the well-being of their immediate neighbors in a way that we had not historically. So I think mutual aid is absolutely about political survival. And we need to really think about how we are able to resist in different ways and also how we are going to be complicit in different ways. You know, I don't want to paint a false picture of resistance where like you're able in every single moment in your life to resist enforcement in all moments, because that's not reality. So I think people are going to need, people who have historically not been comfortable with not having enough resources or not being able to in the moment to like speak out or step up to something that is happening in front of them that is questionable. Like, I think people are going to have to be okay with the gray area of like helping people with shared decision-making deal with like choice A or choice B. Like, what does it look like when state infrastructure that you're used to accessing is no longer safe? How are we going to get people medical care? How are we going to feed people when SNAP gets turned off? How are we going to ensure that people's children are safe and aren't taken from them? You know, I think community organizers have stopped 12 ICE warehouse sales and prevented a total of like 41,500 detention beds just in the last few months. And these are really good examples. The resistance operation Metro Surge prevented a lot of attempted abductions. And people are continuing to care about their neighbors and care about the survival of people who are immediately at risk for deportation in their neighborhoods in a way that I think is really beautiful. So, you know, it's a pretty dark thing we've all been experiencing, but there's also a lot of joy in learning how to survive state repression and also just survive without the state.
This is the Final Straw Radio on the Pacifica Network, and you're hearing our interview with Juan and Fatima about solidarity with immigrants and resisting immigration detention in the Southwest and beyond. Hello again, KPFA. Burst here, breaking in again to remind you that we're in the final week of the Winter Fun Drive. I want to thank you for listening to the Final Straw Radio, airing each week here and on 10 other stations around the country, as of this moment. As an all-volunteer show, we spend hours of our time each week researching struggles, following leads, reaching out to writers and organizers in the hopes that we can provide thought-provoking, challenging, and inspiring content for our broadcast hour. We do this because we believe that people make this world run, and that if enough of us can act together, if enough of us can just open a crack a little bit wider, we can get a little more breathing room. Maybe if we push hard enough against the next round of austerity cuts or evictions or ICE raids, we can get a little taste of winning, and some new people can get the experience of organizing. We believe in the idea of prefiguration, of making the road by walking it, and by accumulating power through struggle. KPFA's thriving is a win for community organizing with a long history of contributing to the movements for justice and popular power. But that win isn't a foregone conclusion. The station's existence and growth to meet the next dawn require contributions from many. You can give back to this station that's been broadcasting Sounds of Freedom since before most of us were born, and so that it can continue after we're gone. A good start is by heading to kpfa.org and clicking the donate button, or giving a call to 1-800-439-5732, that's 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and making a one-time or recurring tax-deductible donation to keep this community radio station and community asset going strong. Thank you for your time, and back to the conversation with Fatima and Juan. Another element to that is that it's prefigurative, right? When we're not only resisting the cruelty in the moment and building these like worthwhile relationships that we find with our neighbors, but this is also by recognizing that the state, as you say, is like that it needs to be anti-statist resistance, recognizing the state for what it is, we're building the alternatives and hopefully building the road while walking it, right? To turn a subcomandante Marcos phrase.
Yeah. That was really powerful to walk into because it touches on exactly what I was going to say. One of the things that we noticed is that being in the kind of too often the eye of the nation when it came to this debate is that we recognized there was an opportunity to resist in ways that had national consequences being far beyond our small community, and that were part of the national discourse. And one of them was narrative change. We really had on our hands the opportunity in a very real and not around way, a very matter of fact way, to show that it was the state that was the chaos in our community and we could be the order. That became our mantra, because you could just see it, and a total devolvement of the state into what in essence has been throughout history for many reasons that we outlined today. Our community has been dehumanized by this state. This has always seen us as a foreign entity and never fully accepted us. So we very matter-of-factly started seeing that we had, even as so-called everyday people, because most of the people that came together for us weren't particularly ideologically bent. We just had one true north of saying, like, we're going to do it in a community way. We weren't part of established nonprofits. We weren't part of the hierarchical system of nonprofits that have dominated this area. And we weren't particularly religious, although we had a spectrum of people from all walks of life. But we saw that opportunity to create change. And a lot of these instances, it was a handful of us resisting these very powerful forces and having all manner of state repression pushed on us. But we understood that if we didn't resist, you know, there would be no resistance to them. But that there was also an opportunity to change. So like Fatima was saying, it's not necessarily that people are on an ideological bend. It's so much of the people in the barrio who come from a history of immigration or witnessing immigration in our community, even by people who are ancestrally from there, sacando burritos and being like, here, you know, giving us $20 to keep up our work, keeping an eye out for immigration. It was everyday people coming up and showing the true spirit of our people, and that resistance that had been built over generations, that it was in defiance of the state, because we really, our conscientious oppositional consciousness, it comes in a very real and drastic way where we're from. But one of the things that I really wanted to leave before, you know, this conversation with is for me, I remember hearing there was this fact about how much the average so-called cishet male in the United States fixated on the Roman Empire. And I remember telling all of our comrades, and we had a house full of migrants in which we would have all manner of conversations that were some of the most interesting we ever had, and telling them, you know, Doug, I was raised around old school Texas racists who educated me very well on that old hate that was foundational to this country. And big part of it was that in their view, diversity was an empire killer. They viewed the balkanization of the Roman Empire as the downfall of the Roman Empire. So for those people, and it speaks to this idea of cultural hegemony and defying cultural hegemony, I would tell our people the best way, ironically, to be an empire killer is to be diverse, be different, be free to be different, be free to be, you know, be proud of who you are is one of the most defiant things as people of color. It is truly an act of resistance to exist and to resist those that would deny you the freedom to be different, the freedom to live your life on your terms. And again, that comes into contestation into a state in which assimilation. And I think that's the fight in our community that we're having amongst ourselves in a true, you know, knockout, drag out fight is against assimilation. And you see it in Texas, where part of our demographic and those who can pass and those with enough privilege accepting and incorporating some of those grotesque ideas and turning even against their own people. And you see that, I get told that time and time again, wherever I go into the country. And I say, you know, that's the face, the grotesque face of assimilation, where you will literally enact inhumane. I mean, the agents that shot those folks in Minnesota were from southern Texas. I'm generationally from Texas. And we're in our part of the Texas is the one that's most identified with the Chicano and Pachuco culture. We're literally called El Chuco, and we're a form of resistance for people. We understand that we're at the forefront of many fights, and one of those is within ourselves. And that's a daily fight. And it's easily won by being proud of ourselves and being who we are and reminding ourselves of who we are.
Yeah, I guess that this is a good time maybe to ask, are there any things that I didn't ask about that you wanted to share while we're having this conversation that occur to you as kind of closing thoughts?
I think I've already said too much, but we've said everything in between. So I'm happy to leave it there. But yes, it's been great to talk about how these things come together in one of the most, you know, fruitful ways I've had conversations in a very long time. So thank you both.
I think the only thing that I'll say about preparing ourselves emotionally and mentally for resistance is that many communities much wiser than our individual selves, like many Indigenous communities, perceive and approach resistance as an intergenerational and lifelong thing. And I just encourage folks to connect with folks in their communities who have already been working on these issues and to show up with an open heart and to also think about their own profile of risk and what they're willing to give up in order to resist the carceral state. And for me, you know, in really dark times, I like to revisit literature that reminds me that people have dealt with and survived incarceration in the past. And I would say like two of the books that I've been revisiting in the last 2 months, as we've experienced like pretty intense repression in the city and the neighborhood that I live in, I've been rereading Gray is the Color of Hope, which is a prison memoir by Irina Rashin-Sugya. And it details her imprisonment in a Soviet labor camp in the 80s. And then the other book that I've been revisiting is No Friend But the Mountain, which is a memoir by the Kurdish-Iranian journalist Biswar Buchani. And it details his illegal and indefinite detention in Manus Island prison. He ended up there for 7 years. The way that he got out was he wrote a book that was smuggled out of the prison line by line, literally in text messages. And then he was able to escape because he got invited to speak at a literary conference somewhere where he was able to apply for asylum. And I think those two texts are really beautiful examples of the like tenacity and the persistence of the human spirit under really extreme conditions. And I think that we all need to be preparing ourselves to be considered like high priority for repression by the state. And I think you only have to look at the FBI's recently published, you know, I don't wish that for our communities, but I think that people need to understand. And also, I think one thing that we didn't touch upon in our interviews is the fear people have of being separated from their children and the endemic sexual abuse that is happening in family detention. This has been noted. This has been an issue of like many legal cases brought against Southwest Keys, which is the operational organization that was in charge of family detention. There's been reports for about a decade of abuse in custody. And I think people need to really understand what is happening in these facilities, which is the wholesale torture, imprisonment, and sexual abuse of minors and adults. And I think anyone who watched what happened unfold in Gaza over the last period of time, like, needs to understand that this is just foreign policy coming home in a way that it always has. You know, Whipple is the locational site of processing and detention in Minneapolis, and it is also historically a place of a death camp against the indigenous folks in our community. And, you know, there's nothing more American than the carceral state in its current form, and this is not an exception. So I think folks who wish to make metaphors around the Third Reich need to understand that, like, the Third Reich was basing their detention and death camp system on the U.S., and this is all very yep. homegrown. So, you know, maybe a dark a dark note to end on, but I think we need to understand where we've come from in order to understand, like, where we're going in our resistance movements.
Thank you, Juan and Fatima, for sharing your thoughts and your experiences with me and with the audience. I guess on that note, too, are there any groups that you want to shout out? Anything that you think will be helpful for people moving forward to take away from this conversation?
Just, I guess for me, it's all the directly impacted people and all the ways that this state has marginalized folks. So I give a shout out to all those communities that, you know, we can't name and we can't list and struggles we can't articulate because of the state that we're in. And it speaks to the resistance we're in. But one day we'll sit and talk openly.
Okay, Fatima and Juan, thank you so much for this conversation. Again, I'm really excited to share it with folks, and I think it'll be super helpful contribution. Take care, and thanks for all the amazing work that you do.
Thank you. Appreciate
Great. It. Thanks for facilitating the conversation. It's been really nice to chat.
Yeah. If you're listening to the radio edition, you can find an additional half an hour by joining in on our podcast or subscribing to your favorite streaming app listed at tfsr.media. This is The Final Straw Radio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions and suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net.
Ibram X. Kendi.
In order to truly create an anti-racist America, and even world, where racial inequality does not exist, and racial inequality does not exist because racial discrimination doesn't exist, the only way to create that is for anti-racists to be in power. But not only for anti-racists to be in power, we need anti-racist policies to be the law of the land. But we don't just need anti-racist policies to be the law of the land, we need anti-racist ideas of racial equality to be the common sense of the people. And we don't just need anti-racist ideas to be the common sense of the people, we need that anti-racist common sense of the people to hold those leaders and those policies accountable.
Advancing the conversation to abolish racism for over 70 years. 94.1 KPFA.
The KPFA Local Station Board is expanding its community outreach and welcomes short presentations from representatives of local community organizations at upcoming online meetings during public comment. The board is looking forward to learning about your organization, its purpose, and how it serves the community. Contact outreach@kpfa.org to find out how you can speak at the upcoming online meeting on Wednesday, March 11th at 6:30 p.m.
You are listening to 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and online at kpfa.org. Coming up next, Against the Grain with Sasha Lilly and CS Song. But first, the news.